Welcome, everyone, to the Indie Week. This issue of The Independent, dated June the 7th of 2024, is read by John Federson, and it's a service for our blind and print-impaired listeners of the North Carolina Reading Service. Musicians retire until the end of our show, and we'll get started now with Indie Week. And I'll begin actually from the IndieWeek.com, which is the basic source for all of our stories now. And this just came through this morning on June 6th, article from Jane Porter, the editor-in-chief, in April. We wrote about the cottages at Idlewild, a new affordable housing development plan for Southeast Raleigh. That is a passion project for North Carolina Central basketball coach Lavelle Moton, who grew up in the Idlewild neighborhood. The project is unique in its partnership with the Raleigh Area Land Trust, RALT, which is financing construction of 18 rental and home ownership duplexes that will be available to low-income families. Under the land trust model, homebuyers will own their homes in the cottages at Idlewild, but not the land on which the homes are situated. Therefore, they'll only pay property taxes on the home value and not the land value, allowing them to keep their home ownership costs low and build generational wealth. The homes will be guaranteed affordable for 99 years. This month, the Wake County Board of Commissioners approved a $900,000 no-interest loan to support construction of the cottages at Idlewild, and construction is set to begin this fall. Shanika Thomas, chair of the Board of Commissioners, in a press statement said, "Our commitment extends beyond the present. We're preserving affordable land for future generations and fostering ongoing economic growth for homeowners. I'm thrilled to witness the creation of generational wealth and equity, empowering low-income homeowners to thrive. Units at the cottages are available to families making below 50% to 60% of the area median income, and potential homeowners could qualify for $60,000 in home buying assistance from the City of Raleigh and other sources. The project is projected to be completed within 1 year." The next article is related, at least tangentially and a little bit more actually, to low-income housing. Voters in Chapel Hill and Orange County will see bonds on their ballots this fall. This November, Orange County will turn out to vote for the next president, governor, and a whole slew of state-level offices. They'll also have a hyper-local issue on the ballot, whether their municipal governments can issue hundreds of millions of dollars in two separate bonds. Chapel Hill residents will decide whether to allow the town to borrow $44 million. The town council has waffled in recent discussions over whether to hold the referendum this year or next year, leading to some consternation from eager voters. The Progressive Triangle blog wrote, "Chapel Hill looks decisions in the eye and asks, do you think we can maybe talk about this over coffee every morning for the next 17 years? Still, at its May 15th meeting, the council unanimously agreed to a preliminary plan and timeline to place the bond on the ballot this year. The draft plan calls for $15 million for affordable housing, $15 million for public buildings, $7.5 million for streets and sidewalks, $4.5 million for parks and recreation, and $2 million for open space and greenways. Mayor Jess Anderson said during the meeting, "This bond issuance will allow Chapel Hill to move forward on important projects without raising taxes. Voter approval allows us to borrow money for those projects at a lower rate, which is really important." In November of 2018, Chapel Hill voters overwhelmingly approved a $10 million affordable housing bond, but advocates at the time argued it should have been bigger. Last year, the council passed an affordable housing plan and investment strategy that recommended the town spend $50 million over the next 5 years. The bond will appear on the agenda for discussion at the meeting, which June 5th, that was yesterday, when the council will introduce the bond orders and schedule a public hearing. Over in Hillsborough last month, Orange County's Board of Commissioners officially decided to move forward with a $300 million schools bond referendum for capital improvements. The county estimates that paying for the bond will require a tax increase of nearly 3.5 cents per $100 of valuation in the county's 25-6 fiscal year. That money would be split between Orange County's two school districts, with Orange County Schools, covering the north and west, receiving about $200, and Chapel Hill, Carrboro City Schools, receiving $100 million. At an April joint meeting between the commissioners and both school boards, Orange County's school superintendent Danielle Jones pointed out the many budget challenges facing the district, including an end to pandemic-era grants from the federal government. Quote, "While the state has the legal obligation and the constitutional obligation for public education, they're not even meeting half of our financial needs today. So we are dependent on local funding if we're going to maintain our level of programming. We may not be able to fund teachers the way they should be funded. But what can we do to make sure our teachers feel respected and valued and that we have a school community we can be proud of?" Chapel Hill Carrboro School Board Chair George Griffin also took that opportunity to thank the commissioners for their support. "We know money's tight, and we know it's tough times, and everybody knows public education is under attack from all fronts, and in that sense, you are our last hope," said Griffin. "Not to be too dramatic about it, but right now it appears to be the case. Orange County continues to make what's considered to be the top effort in the state to fund public education. While a tax increase is never popular, no organized opposition to the bond has yet emerged. At forums for this spring's Orange County School Board of Education election, most of the candidates running for 3 seats on the board rallied around the need for facility improvements. One candidate mentioned the persistent mold in his former office. Another said the school she worked in had to set up trash cans to catch the water when it rained. A 2023 report estimated the current facility deficiency total needs $165 million in Chapel Hill Carrboro schools, including $70 million for roof replacements, $52 million for mechanical systems. Orange County system currently needs $98 million, with the largest need of $29 million for electrical and $23 million for interior finishes. Now, on June 4th, that was 2 days ago, the county commissioners held a public hearing on that bond. We don't have at the Indy Week information about that meeting either, but I'm sure it'll be at least in Indy Week, if not other places, by next week for sure. Over to Durham. The Durham County Commissioners' Chambers on Tuesday evening, this was a week ago Tuesday, was a sea of red. Nearly everyone in the audience wore a Durham Association of Educators t-shirt with a bull logo and white lettering. Rustling posters, some printed and others handmade, urged support for the schools, with messages such as, "Durham schools need Durham's help, and fund the schools. Durham students deserve better." Those entering late joined the row of people standing in the back. There were no more space to sit. For the next 2.5 hours, nearly all 55 speakers, current and former DPS educators, parents, interpreters, occupational therapists, and cafeteria workers shared one plea fully fund the DPS school board's budget request of $27.5 million. Durham County Manager Kimberly Sowell has proposed a more modest increase of $13 million in funding from local schools, $14 million short of what the school system requested. The proposed budget would result in a 3.25 cent tax rate increase, raising the countywide tax to 78.5 cents per $100 of property valuation. Quinton Hedden, instructional assistant at Riverside High, said to cheers and applause, "We need your help. We need to fully fund our public schools. We are overworked, underpaid, and underappreciated. I come to you with my heart pouring out, asking and pleading with you to please save our school system." Speakers named a wide range of reasons to expand the budget, deteriorating buildings, the need for pay raises, support staff and teachers quitting at alarming rates. Several system employees expressed frustration about working part-time jobs to support themselves. Haley Davidson, a science teacher at Brogdon Middle, explained how her two part-time jobs outside of school impact her students. Quote, "It's the hardest for my students, having them ask me if I'm going to their game after school or their band concert and having to say no. I have to go to my second job and watching their faces drop. Our students are wildly aware of the situation their teachers are in." Other teachers and classified staff said their salaries are not enough to make a living and that colleagues have left for other counties that pay better. Ananda Ghosh, a Durham resident, DPS graduate, and a 10-year educator, quote, "These high-quality educators found their way in Durham, and I wanted to do the same, but it gets harder and harder. Insufficient salaries have encouraged turnover," said several speakers. Daniel Kemp, a teacher at Riverside High, quote, "I'm tired of seeing my coworkers burn out and leave. The constant turnover creates a challenging environment for both staff and students." Elizabeth Jones, a DPS parent and teacher, added, "I know families whose children haven't been taught by a certified teacher for 2 years. One parent said that parents have health and safety concerns too. Some of our classrooms are better suited for growing mold than growing children. My son's school was without a functioning HVAC for over a month in 90-degree weather," said another. A few speakers condemned the school system's budget allocation, questioning the decision to build a costly new Durham School of the Arts campus instead of renovating the current one. Catherine Goldstein, homeowner and DPS parent of three, "I am begging you to raise my taxes." They emphasized they would gladly accept a raise in taxes in order to fully fund the schools. "This is the bluest county in North Carolina," added Goldstein. "We have voted for many of you due to your stated commitment to our public schools." While the majority of the hearing consisted of school system requests, three representatives from the sheriff's office also requested increased funding for protective vests. The county commissioners have scheduled several budget work sessions and are expected to vote on final budget approval coming right up on June the 10th. Now, a follow-up to that article includes more details from this same meeting. Sign language interpreters in the schools demanded better pay during that meeting. Meanwhile, the Durham Association of Educators and Supporters called on the board to recognize that union and give it a stronger role in the planning process. The comments by staff who serve deaf students came after department members called in sick last Thursday to protest insufficient pay. After the district's salary debacle, which is well known to listeners of this station, sign language interpreters now earn an average of $900 less per month than we were promised in October of 2023, said interpreter Sarah Leonard, reading from a letter from the staff to the board. Due to this change, many of us are contemplating leaving the district in order to support ourselves and our families with community positions that pay significantly more. If we are forced to leave, the district will find itself in a precarious position, both financially and legally. Other DPS staff also spoke about salary issues. Christy Clem, a DAE member and physical therapist, called for more transparency about these future pay rates, saying, "The classified pay crisis caused employees to leave and destroyed our trust not only with the board, but also with administration. Classified employees don't feel any better now than we did in January." Interim Superintendent Kathy Moore said the district hopes to release individual salary projections for the next school year by the end of this week. Clem was amongst more than 35 individuals who turned out to advocate for the DAE educators on Thursday, many wearing DAE t-shirts and carrying homemade signs, called on the board to formally recognize the union and establish a formal meet and confer policy by the start of the school year. Representatives from 9 other unions, including the Union of Southern Service Workers, Duke Graduate Students Union, and National Nurses United, spoke out in solidarity with the DAE. DAE President Simone Kidu laid out a clear timeline for the board. Quote, "If the board is not ready to formalize union recognition this year, we can take the summer to do all that. We can get all that we can get on the same page about this. If after that the board does not pass a standard union recognition policy at or near the start of the school year, we will have to spend the next year at loggerheads as well." North Carolina is among the few states where public sector employees are prohibited from engaging in collective bargaining. DEA views these meet and confer policy as, quote, "an alternative framework for honoring workers' rights." Efforts to establish a meet and confer policy have been ongoing in Durham. On February 15th, DAE members met with the board, leading to the formation of an ad hoc committee to work towards a meet-and-greet policy. However, the committee has been in tension. DAE posted on Facebook the following day, quote, "Our talks with the district about recognition have broken down. Despite the fact we now represent a majority of DPS workers, the board continues to delay the process, divide workers, and discredit our organizing. Alongside urging the board to establish a formal policy, DAE members expressed anguish over the current state of the district. Educator Shamia Truitt said, "We are in triage. We're in the trenches, as you already know. We can't wait. We're in the middle of a staffing crisis and basically fueled by pay cuts, lack of trust in the district. Quality teachers are leaving left and right. It's like we're bleeding from the arteries." Also on Tuesday, members of the public made another appeal to renovate the current Durham School of the Arts. I mentioned that. All right, so that is a follow-up to that, the first article. This article was more about the efforts, if not to unionize, to at least have recognition for a collective voice for some of these employees. So now I'll move to a different article just published on 2 days ago. There's a new highway marker in Mebane. It showcases the history of a recently recognized Native American tribe. Vicki Jeffries, the tribal administrator of the Okanichi Band of the Saponi Nation, says she was sitting looking at the tribal grounds in Mebane when a vision came to her. She was thinking about how the tribe needed more space to expand, but did not have a lot of money to spend. Jeffries was sitting underneath the shelter, looking at the areas where powwows were held when her vision came to her. "Something said to me, 'Look around,' Jeffries says. I go. wait a minute, the shelter. I think it was the ancestors that said, yeah, look around, you have it right here. On May 30th, the tribe celebrated the unveiling of a highway marker showcasing the tribal grounds from Daly Store Road and the opening of its new community center in the Alamance County town. Now the tribe will have a physical marker showcasing its history, where people can read a little bit about the tribe while driving past its land. The Okanichi Band of the Saponi Nation is a small, newly recognized Native American tribe with close to 25 acres of tribal land located in Mebane. The tribe settled in Alamance, Caswell, and Orange counties after the Revolutionary War, but did not receive state recognition until 2002. Before this, much of the history of the Okanichi was lost, as earlier generations were afraid to claim this part of their identity due to fear of discrimination, and therefore did not pass down the tribal culture. Within the Okanichi tribe, this generational fear was prevalent, and something Tammy Hayes Hill, a cousin of Jeffrey's, and the Okanichi Band of the Saponi Nation's tribal secretary knows well. 20 years ago, a historian knocked on Hayes Hill's door, informing her she is a member of a core family of the Okanichi Band of the Saponi Nation. Before this, Hayes Hill did not even know her family had Native American lineage on both sides. It was something her parents never discussed because they were worried they would face more discrimination. Hayes Hill says, growing up, not knowing who you are always just placed in the category of either white or black. And for us, it was the black community. Leslie Leonard, administrator for the North Carolina Highway Marker Program, says that a marker is not an easy thing to get. A committee of 10 professors from colleges and universities from around the state meet twice a year to decide on new markers. Leonard says they only pass markers for those applications that can qualify and demonstrate statewide significance, not just local or regional significance. These markers are handmade, substantial, and they're expected to last for many, many generations. Historically, there have not been legal protections put in place for Native Americans. Tribes legally were not able to practice meaningful rituals until the American Indian Religious Freedom Act of 1978. Before this act, state and local laws still in effect denied Native Americans the ability to visit sacred sites and use religious symbols. This led to a loss of practices like powwows or expression of culture, and is a large part of why many native languages, such as Tutelo, in the case of the Okanichi, have been lost, leading to a loss of identity. Only recently has their community started to rebuild. When the tribe started doing this work of rebuilding and seeking recognition in 1984, people laughed. Forrest Hazel, Okanichi Commissioner of North Carolina American Indian Heritage Commission, says, at the beginning of Hazel's work with the tribe, things were very different. The tribe didn't have its own land and had to have powwows elsewhere, he says. People viewed the work natives were doing as a joke, but through persistence, the tribe has been able to achieve many of its goals, he says. He wishes that many of the late tribal elders were still around to see the new center and highway marker today. Quote, it's been just at 40 years, and the Indian people of this area have organized, have started working to build something. It's hard because so much has already been lost, but there's a lot of things that if you go and look for them, you can still find. Tony Hayes, tribal chairperson, is grateful for the support from both Okanichi tribal members and other community supporters. That support led to the creation of that highway marker and the community center. And Hayes says, we have been fighting for this moment for a lot of years, and this is just the beginning. This is the tip of the spear as far as I'm concerned. But the best thing I can say is this. This is what happens when nobody cares about who gets the credit. A longish article now about the protests about Gaza and the Israeli invasion there after the terrorism. This was written just a few days ago by Elim Lee. On a Saturday morning, about a month ago, I walked up to Polk Place on the UNC Chapel Hill campus and was greeted with a common scene for any college green. Students lay down on blankets in the grass, communing peacefully. They braided each other's hair, read books, and created art. Lawn chairs were spread out in a circle for the conversation I was after, and I settled into the grass to talk to a couple of different students and faculty members about what the officially named Triangle Gaza Solidarity Encampment meant to them. UNC had joined the international movement of students occupying public space on campus to become physically, visually, and literally unavoidable. These students leveraged their existence and bodies to take up space, to draw the attention of the administrations they endorse with their tuition and knowledge. Their demands are simple. Disclose. Divest. Otherwise, we will not stop. We will not rest. Meanwhile, the students bustled about, synthesized outside threats from the administration, and strategized responses, figuring out how best to disseminate helpful action items for supporters. My friend, a communications liaison for the UNC Students for Justice in Palestine, the SJP, raised a megaphone and shouted out, "A reminder, the UNC administration does not want us here. They are actively trying to make the place hostile." By then, the administration had halted trash collection services around Polk Place and locked the buildings containing bathrooms around the green. These were incremental steps to pushing the students out, leading up to a strategic surprise police confrontation. That was been reported widely before. Have you heard of the 3.5% rule? Political scientist and public policy professor Erica Chenoweth found it only takes 3.5% of the population to force systemic change. Crunch the numbers, and all it would take is every other student in a college to be on the side of demanding that something changes, and something would change. The students are not alone. Professor Emily Rogers sits on the Duke faculty and says her role is using her, quote, power and security to protect students and listening to what student organizations are asking of us. Allyship in action, a guard for what it truly means to transition knowledge into praxis. There are professors across the nation using their standing within academia to buttress student action. Rogers, parenthetically, was arrested the following Tuesday by police who took away her cane and shoved her to the ground. Abi, a Duke student in attendance at the UNC encampment, describes it as an atmosphere that is so loving, so caring. As a Jewish woman, she attended Shabbat within the encampment. When it was time for Muslim students to say their prayers, Abi reflected on the human chain others formed around them, protecting their interfaith community from the counter-protesters. She says the UNC encampment is exciting because it's a public space, a place to converge and build momentum. Erie, a state university student and a member of the Young Democratic Socialists of America, calls the encampment a grassy, centric, perfect environment. We're visible, and that represents the idea of what's possible. Leslie Kramer, a student at Meredith College, says coming here is a reminder that you're not alone in your fight. Ennis, a state student, NC State, who's also a YDSA member, says, strategically, Chapel Hill is the place to have it because the decision makers are here. Elise Crystal is an English professor at UNC and holds a doctoral degree. She points out that UNC is actively in community with the town of Chapel Hill and its history. Across the street, the Peace and Justice Plaza is where the Occupy protests took place. Community outrage often confers with student activism. Crystal says, "We haven't bought any food because the community has donated so many provisions. This university is the center of the community. If anything is happening, it's happening here." Kramer notes that thinking of protesters as either students or non-students is an arbitrary divide. "They want to divide us," echoes Ennis, "between schools, but this is a fight for everyone. The media will frame us as students, but we're acting as ordinary people. Anyone can encamp anywhere relative to a seat of power." Born in 1999 myself, I understand the world these college students grew up in. Through school shootings, loss of health care rights, police brutality, we watched as the cops ran away from protecting us and the government actively harmed us, and we learned that direct mutual aid is the only way to make a difference. My generation is Spitfire embodied. We no longer take our rights or liberties as guaranteed, so we fight like we have nothing to lose. Students from other local colleges have been involved in the efforts at their own institutions. At Meredith College in Raleigh, students launched an SJP chapter this semester and held a die-in protest with 9 students. While small, it was still engaging. Kramer says the impact is different, but all still important. Erie says the UNC encampment is a great reference point, and she's learning here how to replicate these actions elsewhere. It's a hands-on education. She says you can't Google this, you know. Abby notes the difference between public and private universities and how Duke tends to, quote, manage its image. She says it can be difficult for students to organize and collaborate as things tend to get shut down before traction can build. But that didn't stop Duke from holding its own Stop Scholasticide rally in early March. Duke academics and staff for Justice in Palestine held a vigil for the educators, students, and schools killed and destroyed in Gaza, gathering on Duke's campus and calling for Duke to condemn Israel's actions. Abby proclaims that, student activism aside, it's important that Gaza has the biggest spotlight. In contrast to our peaceful green, every university in Gaza has been destroyed. And that's why we're here, Abby says. They're going after scholarship and knowledge because those things are dangerous. University students who are learning to use their voice are a threat to the powerful. Abby emphasizes the killing of children in Gaza means there is, quote, no one to remember to carry on the legacy of what it means to be Palestinians. We can't just stop the deaths and killing, but we have to humanize the culture and realize that there is more suffering than death. Abby says people must think of the atrocities as more than a statistic, that these are not just Palestinians, a label which washes away the individualization of each death. You shouldn't be confronted with this and walk away okay. If us feeling okay is more important than the genocide, then we are not okay. The members of the Circle on the Grass reflect on what our duties are as American bystanders. Abiz, as an American, you need to subject yourself emotionally to the immense fear and grief that's coming from our country's funding and support, to feel that grief every day. On college campuses across the nation demanding that universities stop funneling tuition dollars into Israel's industrial military complex, the masses gathered are generating hope like a precious resource. Kramer says, hope is what's going to save the Palestinian people. They're going to save themselves. We're building up the hope, and hope is action to them. From across the world, they add, Palestinians' children have had to find the hope within themselves to survive once the bombs stop. Our duty as residents of an imperialist nation is to resist our system and foster that sacred hope. Ennis says he hopes this is a focusing moment that, quote, it radicalizes everyone in it or that walks by it. He compares it to how anyone who is protesting Vietnam will remember that time. Protests that spur movements are reference points for radicalizing one's belief. They root values that stick through lives. He tells me about how Vietnam protests are an entry point into conversations with elders who are ambivalent about the Palestinian cause. When I tell Crystal, the UNC English professor, I'll come back on Tuesday to photograph the encampment, she crosses her fingers. Hopefully, we're still here by then, she says. They were, but not for much longer. That day, following morning arrest, UNC students raised a Palestinian flag on the quad as counter-protesters chanted, USA. Then they supplanted it with Old Glory. Did they understand what was behind each decorated fabric waving in the wind? Kramer says it's often hard to imagine the sheer scale of human suffering happening in Gaza. The foregone era that people are imagining as pacifying enough to return to is still apartheid and oppression. As I'm leaving, a Palestinian student shares some thoughts with me. They condemn U.S. actions as bipartisan consensus for continued war for the benefit of the Western Empire. They say the current spread of encampments is international solidarity. For the first time, they say, I feel less alone. All right, Durham, now for something a bit lighter. Serving up scoops, Persian style. Ice cream. With ice cream shops sprinkled throughout the city, anyone craving a sweet treat in Durham doesn't need to look far, but a new player in town, pistachio ice cream, is shaking up the oversaturated ice cream market and putting an ancient twist on the popular dessert. Pistachio, which opened on Chapel Hill Road in October, draws inspiration from Persia, the historic region that preceded modern Iran, where ice cream production dates back to 500 BC and incorporates local flavors like rose water and saffron. The Chorumi family, the shop's owners, don't just want to convert vanilla ice cream lovers into consumers of Turkish coffee and ginger rose water, some of the unique flavors on Pistachio's menu. They're hoping to become a focal point of the Tuscaloosa-Lakewood neighborhood, helping transform that area into a more walkable and family-friendly environment. So far, Pistachio has been a hit, its owners say. A warm winter helped attract customers during what's usually a slow time for ice cream consumption. Manial Churumi, one of the owners, says, we weren't expecting the volume of popularity we had in the beginning. During the first 3 months, we ran out of four flavors immediately. Erica Weinberg, who lives in that Tuscaloosa-Lakewood area, heard about pistachio from a bunch of people in the neighborhood, she said, while digging into a cup of cucumber sorbet on a recent Saturday. Olivia Goodwin first discovered that shop on a social bike ride, sampling a ginger rosewater milkshake, and has visited twice since, saying, the times I've been here, it seems like it's been busy, not overwhelmingly, but definitely busy. Pistachio's ambiance is steeped in Persian culture with Middle Eastern influences evident throughout. Among its most popular flavors are date, Turkish coffee, and saffron pistachio. Each table contains canisters of lemon juice and sour cherry, allowing patrons to customize their falooda. That's a traditional Italian sorbet made with rice noodles. A replica of a samovar, a device used to make Persian tea, sits atop the ice cream counter. While Pistachio officially opened its doors in October, plans for the shop had been in the works for about 5 years. Chirumi said, "We didn't want to rush to do it and have regrets about things we would want to fix while we were open. We started construction during COVID, and then things kind of slowed down for us during that point. But it was something we thought about doing as a family since we were children." Manil and his siblings were born in Los Angeles, but their parents, who are co-owners of Pistachio, left Iran during the revolution in the 1970s. Surrounded by a large Persian community in Los Angeles, the Chirumi family regularly visited Mashti Malone's, an ice cream shop renowned for its authentic Persian flavors. Chirumi also worked there in the summers, allowing him to learn the ins and outs of the business. The Chirumis now hope to serve a scoop of their roots to Durham's small but growing Persian community. When he moved here in 1994, Chirumi said there were just a handful of Persian families, but that number has grown significantly, he says. They import their ice cream directly from Mashti Malone's in Los Angeles. Chirumi says, "We haven't started any of our signature flavors yet, but we're working with the makers to start making our own, and they're teaching us how to make it ourselves." This isn't the Chirumi's family running a business together. The mother owns Indigo Montessori, a preschool and a kindergarten on West Main Street, and runs it with the help of the other family members. Despite occasional family disagreements, the biggest challenge, according to Manial, has been meeting growing customer demand. The Chirumis are gearing up for the summer, anticipating higher foot traffic in the warmer months. Chirumi said, "I got pints ready to go and ice cream sandwiches made." They're banking on Pistachio's prime location, sandwiched between a Pilates studio, pet spa, and a taco restaurant, to attract passersby and establish the shop as a cornerstone of the Tuscaloosa Lakewood neighborhood. The Chirumis recently installed a playground for children in Pistachio's side yard and will soon offer protein shakes for people leaving their Pilates workouts. They also hope to secure a beer and wine license to serve alcohol to the parents who come with their kids. And Chirumi said, "We really want this to be a full service stop for the walkable family." All right, here's this another nutrition-related article from Durham that I've kept in my briefcase for over a month now, written April 25th, and I don't believe I've covered it. Sam Overton writes about the North Durham Farmers Market. A diverse, close-knit community is key. The commute from downtown Durham to the site of Bull City's newest farmers market is about a 10-minute drive. A few minutes after crossing over I-85, you'll find yourself navigating windy two-lane roads dotted with the occasional small business or church before turning into Helena Craig and Sylvia Williams' property. Williams says this is Soul Sanctuary. It's land we bought so we could share it with the community. We have this nice event space here, and we have this nice land for people to use. What we knew was that there were farmers markets around, but there really wasn't anything in North Durham for people to access. Well, the first North Durham Farmers Market event was held on April 6. The market operates on the first and third Saturday of every month and will run through November. Once again, they operate on the first and third Saturday of every month and will run through November. Williams explains these details by her makeshift stall, where seedlings are packed in solo cups and a large bulletin board covers a card table. Music pours from the front porch of Soul Sanctuary's main attraction. That's their beautiful two-story farmhouse painted denim blue as a small crowd moves from vendor to vendor. Craig, who is married to Williams and is the North Durham Farmers Market manager, is also buzzing about. The bi-monthly event is her creation. After witnessing her wife's evolution as a community gardener, Craig felt compelled to create a unique experience in their neck of the woods. This event is more free-flowing than your average farmer's market, and instead of the usual early morning hours, takes place in the afternoon. Craig says one of the things that we wanted to do was just be different in a way that felt important to us and our people. A lot of people, as much as they want to go to a farmer's market, are not Saturday morning people. Even just scheduling hours from noon to 4 p.m. is accessible to different people. The strategy paid off. Although not quite as crowded as some of Durham's long-standing outdoor markets, there was a special sense of kinship among the 100 or so people at Soul Sanctuary. Among the roughly 25 vendors, about a third sold typical farmers market fare, eggs, vegetables, seedlings, and the rest feature ready-to-eat snacks or wares like goat milk soup, homemade pottery, or books. Another one of Craig's priorities was to center the retailers' identities. BIPOC vendors, LGBTQ vendors, and the female-owned businesses made up the bulk of the stalls. Three of the next four events support marginalized communities. May 25th will celebrate AAPI, Heritage Month. June 8th will be a Pride celebration. That's coming up in just 2 days. And June 22nd will highlight Juneteenth. By focusing on a collectively diverse makeup of a smaller farmer's market, she hopes that vendors who might previously have faced more obstacles selling their wares will have more room to spread their wings. The North Durham Farmer's Market also accepts SNAP EBT benefits for eligible products. And Craig says, in taking that on, it became fairly clear it's hard to break into places where you can begin selling your products. Rather than being frustrated that it would be hard to break into a market, it made sense for us to open up land that we have. It's primarily newer, more beginner farmers, mixed with different complements of businesses. In a community where a small group of vendors pull together for a Saturday afternoon farmer's market, the little touches are what matter. Vendors told me the stories behind their homemade products and explained their path to that industry. One even let me hold a baby goat. Williams says, I grew up on a small farm in Virginia in the country, and my dad always used to have a garden. I joined the military, traveled and all of that, and then once I settled down in North Carolina, I started gardening as a hobby, growing enough for Helena and myself, and then I was like, this is pretty cool. So I believe now to close this that Soul Sanctuary probably has a website. At least it's highlighted as if it were a link. The North Durham Farmers Market is the name, and it is a 10-minute drive north, crossing I-85. And they probably have maps and everything one could need to get there if one wanted to. Well, coming in at 8 minutes to go, I will read you an article about Nance, a musician, a musical creator, written by Ryan Coca. It's somewhat irrelevant to Nance's new single, For You, but also not completely irrelevant, to state that my favorite social media trend of late has been a series of videos of a kid watching lights turn off. That's it. He appears on screen, announces that the light behind him will soon be turning off, and eventually they do. He then says with admirably consistent gusto each time, "Oh, they turned off. Okay, make sure you like and follow. Goodbye." If you're at all familiar with social media and the modern attention economy, you won't be surprised to hear that this account, which uploaded its first post less than 3 weeks ago, has now 243 followers. And the author, Ryan, says Super Empty's account, which I've been carefully and laboriously tending to since January, has 610. Now, I might mention that Super Empty is a feature now shared in IndieWeek as a musical selection and a focus on one piece of music or another. Lights Off Kid is no menace. The massive popularity of his videos is arguably a demonstration of our gluttonous non-stop content cycle and the algorithms that power it at their most wholesome and benign. But it's hard not to see his stratospheric rise in a matter of weeks, with recent partnerships of Two Golf, Texas Roadhouse, and the U.S. Air Force Academy, for something as simple as watching the lights turn off, as an uncomfortable reminder of the simplicity with which fame, at least of a certain kind, can be achieved in our social media molded era of the internet age, and subsequently how hopelessly drawn many are to chasing it. From bogus YouTube business gurus to AI-generated music and art, modern life is awash in scams that promise a swift escape from the crushing pressures of capitalism. Shameless gambits for quick cash or notoriety are the expected norm, and there's an ever-broadening understanding that it's increasingly impossible to know if what we're seeing or hearing is actually real. Maybe that's why it's so refreshing, especially within a genre historically known for a certain amount of fake-it-till-you-make-it bluster and posturing, to see more rappers dropping the facade, turning inward and creating mirror material out of their own insecurities and doubts, rather than trying to convince us of things we may otherwise suspect to not be true. The most prominent example of this last Friday was Rhapsody's long-awaited, deeply introspective fourth studio album, Please Don't Cry, but also released, although to less fanfare, was the excellent single For You by Raleigh veteran Nance, which in its own ways tackled many of the same themes: identity, acceptance, the pitfalls of seeking happiness in external validation. Though it carries a similar sonic texture to his song from years past, courtesy of production mainstay Fourth Shift, For You depicts an artist not only sharper, more focused, and more original in his songwriting, but maybe most importantly, one who, after years of striving for satisfaction, is genuinely content. While Nance's creative outside-the-box marketing campaigns have regularly earned him some of the best awareness and recognition among indie MCs in Raleigh, the same couldn't always be said in the realm of critical acclaim. 8 years ago, 25-year-old, and considering myself some kind of serious authority on hip-hop, I wrote for IndieWeek, exhaustively comparing one pop culture reference to the next prevents Nance from taking listeners anywhere, emotionally or narratively. And almost every rapper today is taking notes from Drake's blueprint, but the correlations on Everything I Need are overt and unavoidable. I had nice things to say, too, but when he laments on for you that the local scene never embraced the kid. I can think of at least one thing it may be in reference to. Undeterred, Nance continued releasing singles and last year returned to full-length albums with Everyday Dream, which saw the rapper embracing vulnerability, getting more personal than ever before, questioning after years of rapping directly and indirectly about making it, what making it means after all, had to figure out my self-worth, and I'm really worth it. Even if the show goes on, it's closed curtains to the man I used to be, truthfully. I wanted to win so bad, but I was losing me. On For You, he dials into that same ethos of acceptance and moving beyond past versions of himself with brooding lyrics like Press Record and I Kill the Old Me, and Have to Show What Was Meant for Me, Only to Myself, Only Thing That Matters. With the same pity, smoothly staccato refrains, might once time been used for empty calorie rap platitudes here, they cut right to the heart of universal, deeply human concepts like self-image and personal fulfillment. With a dreamy, reverberating chorus that cleverly inverts the song's title, Never Did It For You, No, Never Did This For You, Nance rejects the validation of others as a motivating force behind his music. To some degree, it's plainly a lie. Like almost any other creative, his portfolio suggests plenty of art that was made at least in part with the external validation of others in mind. But rather than historical revisionism, it reads like a daily affirmation about why, presumably in the days before thinking about streams and downloads and shares, he got in front of a mic in the first place. Amidst the various shortcuts and seductions of our gimmicky, algorithm-fueled, get-rich-quick world, it's a reminder we could all use from time to time. Here's hoping it stays top of mind for Lights Off Kid, at least his parents, too. And I'm turning the lights off at this weekly issue of Indie Week, John Feddersen, saying that it exists now as a podcast at ncreadingservice.org. And we will be with you next week with the next issue of the Independent Indie Week. So long for North Carolina Reading Service.